This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. A Republican debate that featured everyone except the guy who's likely to be the nominee. A political scandal that just keeps getting intertwined in current political campaigns. The NCAA finally addresses the issue of hungry athletes, and hungry basketball fans nearly clean out a burrito joint. Those are just a few of the stories we'll be covering in our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. Joining me today in studio is Bill Curry. He's our regular political analyst, but he's taking the place of Colin McEnroe today, who's away on vacation. Bill, it's good to see you.
As if anyone could.
As if anyone could actually take Colin's place, but it's good to see you here, Bill. Thanks so
Great
much for coming
here,
in.
John.
Also joining us to talk a little bit about Obamacare and also about the debate that she covered, Arielle Levin-Becker, who's a health reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Hi, Arielle. How are you?
Hi.
And in just a moment, we want to welcome in Alan Greenblatt from NPR.org. We want to welcome you to the conversation, of course, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can always tweet us at Where We Live. On Friday, five of the six Republican candidates for governor met for their first debate. It was held at the Mark Twain House in Hartford. One of the things that Arielle tweeted at the debate at the Mark Twain House, behind the candidates on the wall, it says, "If you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything." I loved that. I thought that was a nice touch. What was the mood like in this room? This was a group of five candidates, not including the front runner Tom Foley, and it's the first real chance for them to mix it up in a debate like this. What was your overwhelming impression of the day?
So this was their first televised debate, and I think maybe the better term for it would be sort of a candidate showcase more than a debate, because the format was really each got a chance to speak, and then after each went, they would get sort of 30 seconds for it. It was described as rebuttal, but really there wasn't a lot of challenging of each other. It wasn't head-to-head. Really, anytime there were attacks, they were focused on the governor, the Democrat governor that they're all seeking to replace. So it was really much more candidates kind of describing themselves, and you got kind of a glimpse of how they wanted to portray themselves in advance of the nominating convention.
A candidate showcase. I like that idea. So what were they showcasing? Any differential between the five here?
On most issues, they really were very similar. There were certainly it might have been, you know, different shades of a similar color more than there were sort of stark disagreements. The one exception to that would have been on gun legislation that came out of the legislature after the Newtown shootings. Four of the candidates were very critical of it. And one of the candidates is Senate Minority Leader John McKinney, who helped craft that bill and who also represents Newtown and supported it. And so he was in a position of defending the legislation and the reason he voted for it, while the other candidates were critical of it.
Bill, you took a look at this. What did you make of the debate?
I thought, first of all, as you recall, I've been in a few of these.
You have.
And it reminded me of something I'd forgotten, which is just how stressful they are for the participants, listening especially to Martha Dean. I thought of sort of a high school debater, you know, kind of sweating the quarterfinals in the tournament. And I understand, I identify with it. I recall that, but it really brought that back to me. I thought some of them really weren't, you know, clearly, obviously weren't ready to be doing this. You know, with all respect to Visconti and Mayor Loretta, you look at the end and think, tell me again why you're doing this. You know, after a whole debate, why is it you want to be governor? And I thought, you know, again, Boughton and McKinney looked the strongest. I would agree that it wasn't a sharply differentiated field. They have a case to make. Again, the Republicans. I left thinking two things. One, that none of them understand that the campaign, the real public campaign against Malloy, has already begun, and that they needed to be much more prepared with a message and an argument to make. They won't have many opportunities like this. They're hard to come by, and I thought, especially where Senator McKinney was concerned, and about, and who's had some previous experience in statewide politics, that they would have understood this, and I thought that they didn't. There's a debate to be had here, and partly because of the format. When you have so many candidates on the stage and there's no real rebuttal, it's a place where people can hide their ignorance and they can hide their differences, which they all did.
Let's hear a little bit from Mark Boughton, the mayor of Danbury, speaking at this debate.
You know, part of being what we're doing here is being leaders, and it's unfortunate that one candidate opted not to attend today. I think the delegates that go to the convention next month, I think the people of Connecticut and the Republicans in Connecticut ought to be able to hear from all of us in terms of what our positions are. That's how you lead. You lead from the front. You don't lead by hiding somewhere else in the state of Connecticut.
And Ariel, he's talking there about Tom Foley. How much of the discussion was about Tom Foley, the front runner, according to the Quinnipiac polls, not just the front runner, but by a quite substantial margin, the man who finished just a few thousand votes short of beating Dan Malloy during the last election cycle. He wasn't there. Were people talking about Tom Foley not being there beyond Mark Bowden here?
No, that was pretty much the extent of it, that comment right there. He made some additional comments about Foley afterwards when speaking to reporters. But no, Foley really didn't come up during the debate. All the attacks were really focused, aside from the one you just heard on Dan Malloy.
And from everything that you have suggested, Bill, especially this early in a campaign, does it make any sense for Tom Foley to go mix it up with five other people at the Mark Twain House in an afternoon?
Yeah, no, I know why he wasn't there. We'll probably come back to this, but, you know, for other extraneous circumstances, competition from a former governor and so forth, it wasn't that big a showcase for them. It wasn't that important a stop as it might have been. So, for tactical reasons, he didn't. On the other hand, a confident candidate in the last Senate campaigns, all the candidates showed up at all their debates from beginning to end, including the eventual nominees. It gives me a sense about Foley as well that I had also of Linda McMahon last time out, which is that he was running a second time without having corrected any of the deficiencies of his first campaign. And in both cases, it was without learning enough about the substance of the job, about state government in Foley's case, about federal issues in McMahon's case. And I think that just because you have a lot of money, and you can't just come back here and convince that you just didn't have quite the right ad, or you know that you're going to catch a better break next time.
But you did suggest
that he should have been there with a message, and he should have been ready to go.
These Republicans have a case to make. They have a case to make about the work that Dan Malloy has done during his time as governor. It's a case that some Democrats on the left side of the Democratic Party are making quite strongly. Do you think that Tom Foley coming back after a fairly strong showing, narrowly losing to Dan Malloy, has a case to make to the people of Connecticut that maybe you should have tried me instead?
Sure. I mean, although if you just put a period at the end of that sentence and that's the case, then it's not a weak case. I've said on this show before that I think that Foley is the candidate that Malloy can most easily defeat. I just don't. And this won't be a great year for Democrats. It won't be as bad as 2010. There is substantial dissatisfaction with the administration, but I don't see him capitalizing on it. When you talked about the critique that's out there, the closest person in this debate was McKinney by far. You had one candidate promise to eliminate the entire income tax, another the entire sales tax. Because of the format, nobody had to explain how they'd do that.
How that would happen, yes.
And McKinney talking about property tax reform. You had lots of bromides about how we should all be better people in response to the questions about ethics, and McKinney rattling off a list of specific differences he'd had with the Democrats over the last few years in order to try to make this a more honest and open government. He still needs a lot of work, frankly, in terms of his presentation, which surprises me given his experience. But there, you know, if you were trying to pour through that debate on that and three or four other areas, you could see the outline of an argument. But they didn't really – none of them, not even McKinney, really made it that day.
We're talking in the Wheelhouse today, our weekly news roundtable with Bill Curry and R.L. Evan Becker of the Connecticut Mirror. We'll take your calls at 860-275-7266 in just a moment. But I want to bring in Alan Greenblatt. He's a political reporter for NPR.org. He's been taking a look at this campaign for governor from an outsider's perspective, taking a look at the national view on this. And, Alan, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us. Alan Greenblatt, are you there? We seem to have lost Alan Greenblatt, so we will try to reestablish a line with him in just a moment. One of the things that he's writing about is Governor Malloy and the way he has been leading in the course of the last few months, the last year or so, some of the topics that he's made very, very important, sounding an awful lot like President Barack Obama, talking about a 10-10 minimum wage, having President Obama show up at his campaign rallies or show up to back him. Do you see any similarities between Obama and Malloy at this point, Bill?
Yeah, I do. I've always seen similarities between them. And I would just say I'm not sure if one of the questions about the 2014 race that you see constantly bandied about in political columns is whether or not Democrats can energize the presidential election base to turn out in presidential or near to presidential type numbers. What is it that takes the base of this party and inspires and motivates it enough to come out and participate? And I don't think that the president or the governor or any Democrats that I really see in the horizon, no particular criticism of Malloy in this case, that I don't think that they've found that. And there is – the attempt to do it right now is to enunciate these populist themes. But as with the Republicans that I just talked about, it sort of just sounds thematic. Even Malloy has the one great advantage of having passed the minimum wage bill here. But the Democratic – the sudden turn of corporate Democrats to a populist message I don't think is going to do without a lot more substance put on the table than people seem ready to put on.
I think we have Alan Greenblatt back, and I'd like to welcome Alan in from NPR.org. Talk a bit about the similarities you see perhaps between our governor, Daniel Malloy, and the current president, Barack Obama, the things they're running on, the things that they're maybe standing for right now, Alan.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, Bill was just talking about the minimum wage, which Malloy managed to get through at the exact number, 1010, that Obama's been talking about. After Newtown, your state did pass the new gun restriction, which, of course, didn't happen in Congress. My understanding, I haven't looked into it deeply, but your reporter will know more. But my understanding is, you know, as in terms of the Obamacare health exchanges, Connecticut has run pretty well. It's now being emulated by other states. So to the extent that Democrats think these are winning messages, in Connecticut it's not just talk because the governor has been able to get some of these policies through.
Ariel, maybe you can pick up on that idea. This is, again, one of the things that Governor Dan Malloy is going to be touting. Maryland not doing a very good job with their health care rollout. They turn to Connecticut to emulate what's happening here. Is that a winning idea for Governor Malloy that we have a replicable model in Connecticut for health care reform?
I'm sure that's something that they're hoping for. Certainly, Connecticut's gotten a lot of attention as a state that's done relatively well in rolling out the health reform law. The exchange system was functional throughout the open enrollment period, which was absolutely not the case in many parts of the country. And they signed up about 200,000 people, the majority into Medicaid. The criticism that Republicans have made is that we still don't know at this point how many of the people who have newly signed up for private insurance are people who truly were uninsured in the past as opposed to people who had private insurance in the past and either had to change their plans because of the health law or simply chose to change their plans, and so what effect it's had on the uninsurance rate. We should have some numbers on that in the next few months, but right now that's sort of been one of the open sources of debate.
But having numbers on that in the next few months, heading into midterm elections, heading into a gubernatorial election in Connecticut, that's actually really important. If we start to see numbers that swing one way or the other, we start to learn a little bit more about the makeup of the people who are getting insurance, Ariel. This could actually make a difference politically.
Yeah, absolutely it could. I think another factor is there were a lot of people who had private insurance plans that they then lost because of the new requirements of the law. It's not a gigantic number compared to the overall electorate, but many of those people were very upset about it. And so you're going to have some passion there. And to the extent that that becomes an issue, I think that's going to be a factor. I think, as always, you know, with healthcare issues and elections, one of the big questions is the extent to which that's really going to drive people compared to economic issues, things like jobs that that I think sometimes polls would suggest sort of tend to drive things a little bit more.
And we're going to talk more about healthcare in a little bit when we come back from our break. Alan Greenblatt, before our break, though, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about the politics of all this. President Obama certainly is very popular amongst many Democrats, but not as popular at this point in his presidency as many would have assumed he would be. Do you think that Dan Malloy running essentially with Barack Obama again in 2014 is something that's going to work for Dan Malloy?
Well, I think isn't Obama's approval numbers a bit underwater in Connecticut now for the first time? I mean, like I say, he's not a super popular figure. I think Bill makes a good point. You know, I don't know if Obama Obama's mantle is enough to drive out some Democratic turnout. But, you know, I don't think it's a question of whether I drew this comparison in my article that Malloy is running on an Obama platform. I don't know how much Malloy will state that as opposed to stating these policies that we on the national level associate with Obama, and Malloy saying, I was able to get these things done.
Bill?
Right. You know, it's just the point I was going to make, that in reading Allen's article, it occurred to me that contrast, whether it's minimum wage or the health care exchange or meaningful gun control, that there are a set of things here, and you can say, well, it's because we're Connecticut. But any governor who is in office and who has gone out on a limb to support these things gets the credit for it, rightly so. And so, in a sense, it's not so much the comparison to Obama as the contrast that would be of greater use to him.
We're talking with Bill Curry, our political analyst, Ariel Levenbecker from the Connecticut Mirror, Alan Greenblatt from NPR.org. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Neil Vigdor from the Hearst newspapers to talk a little bit more about some of the politics that we've just heard about in the last week, the Governor John Rowland effect. We'll also talk a little bit more about UConn basketball, how it's impacting the bottom line of a burrito company, and how maybe student-athletes might get fed after all. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, which we do each Wednesday. Usually Colin McEnroe is sitting directly to my left, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show, but he's away. So Bill Curry, our political analyst, is filling in ably, I think, for Colin, doing a very nice job, Bill.
That's very civil of you to say that, John.
Well, no, I
certainly appreciate it.
I want to give credit where credit is due. Also joining us is Ariel Levenbecker, who reports on health care and other things for the Connecticut Mirror. We'll be bringing her back into the conversation in a moment. On the phone with us is Alan Greenblatt, who's a political reporter for NPR.org. Alan, I'd like to just continue this little conversation that we started about politics in Connecticut. You've been writing about Governor Daniel Malloy's reelection effort, but you've also been talking to some of the Republicans who are trying to take his place. From the perspective of a national political reporter, what do you see about the possibilities of somebody unseating Dan Malloy this year?
Well, they're obviously pretty good. I mean, his poll numbers are not great. You know, the major issue of the campaign probably that we really haven't touched on, Ariel mentioned briefly, was his economy. You know, Connecticut has kind of underperformed. I mean, the whole country has been struggling during these past 3.5 years that he's been in office, but, you know, Connecticut has not done well, relatively speaking. So he's certainly vulnerable. There's really no question.
You know, the thing is, a lot of places have economies that aren't doing that terribly well. I'm wondering how much that's settling on the shoulders of Republicans or Democrats, how much it's settling on the shoulders of governors leading states. Is that really being seen by people as their fault, or is this still an outgrowth of the 2008-2009 problems and the continued recession or slow recovery?
Well, 2008 and 2009 are a long time ago now, and the people who've been in office for a full term are going to take responsibility, and it's a truism of politics that whether you're the president or the governor, you get way more blame than you deserve when the economy is bad and way more credit than you deserve when the economy is good. They don't really control the economy, but that's what will be on voters' minds, and you know, if the economy's not good, it's tough for incumbents of either party.
Getting back to this debate that Ariel attended last week, the first televised debate between five of the candidates, not including Tom Foley, who are looking to unseat Governor Daniel Malloy. One of the big topics was another former Governor John Rowland, who we've talked about quite a bit on the program, also a former talk show host on WTIC. He's under indictment on 7 counts. He's going to trial, it seems, on these counts. It would be the second go-around in a corruption trial for John Rowland. When asked about John Rowland at this debate, what were people saying? What were these five Republicans saying?
Many of the candidates sort of pivoted the answer to talk more about Governor Malloy and his administration and sort of a general what they described as sort of, you know, questions or sort of worse in government. John McKinney spoke about having called for Rowland to resign back when he was governor. And you know, his call for an inspector general's office. But a lot of the focus was on the Malloy administration, which was sort of consistent with how many of the candidates approached the debate. Martha Dean did speak about she spoke a lot about sort of principles and larger themes during the debate. And one of the things she talked about was that in her mind, you know, the people we elect are a reflection of us. She said, you know, if you elect people who spend too much, it's because we're spending too much. If you elect people who aren't truthful, it's because we're not truthful, which was sort of a different tone than many of the other candidates took.
I've always thought about you, Ariel. You're just not that truthful. It's mostly – I think it's your fault. It's our fault.
I think
really.
It's our fault, really.
It's our fault.
Every time she fibs, I take responsibility.
It's Bill's fault. Asking Bill to comment on what John Roland might mean to Republicans this year is – I may be setting myself up for something, but go ahead, Bill. I mean, do you think that John Roland actually plays any sort of a role?
Yeah, he does.
Do you think so?
Yeah. In the following way, for
Because a lot of people think we're probably making too much of this. He's a guy who was a governor a long time ago. He's a talk show host. He's going to maybe go back to jail. We don't know. You know, we've forgotten him.
You could make too much of it. But let me just give you one example, okay? Well, watching that Republican debate, all I could think of I thought of Jimmy Fallon. And who has a little bit he does on Friday nights, thank you notes, where someone plays some elegiac music and he says, you know, thank you, Polar Vortex, for ruining opening day.
Yeah.
You know, and thanks people that he's not really grateful toward. And I just looked at all the Republican candidates, and here they are in, was it Harriet Beecher Stowe or the Mark Twain House? And having this debate. And there's Roland down being indicted, you know, totally just blowing their story off the newspapers. People may feel they pay too much attention to the Roland story generally, and I think in some ways we do. We can't help but be fascinated with the train wreck of his life. It's the wrong question we keep asking, how could he? The real question is, how could we enable him for decades? And it goes to ethics issues and the watchdog and all kinds of things about state government that could be an issue for a challenger to Malloy, but which Roland, not only does he tarnish the Republican brand, but he moves the debate off the stage. This is going to be a soap opera that occupies us for the rest of this calendar year at least. And it will make, I guarantee you, far less space in the media and in people's energy and available energy and attention for the governor's race. And every challenger needs that space.
I want to welcome in quickly Neil Vigder, who writes for the Hearst newspapers in Connecticut, about another way this might all be entangled. I'll read from the top of his article from yesterday's newspaper. Two political operatives who held positions of authority in the congressional campaign that employed former Governor John Roland off the books in 2012, an arrangement that led to Roland's indictment last week and guilty pleas by a candidate and her husband, are now employed by Tom Foley, the frontrunner for the Republican nomination for governor. Neil, so explain this. These are two folks who worked for the Lisa Wilson Foley campaign who are now working for Tom Foley. Are they going to have to testify in this Roland case?
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on. Good morning. There is a strong likelihood. So what we know is that Christopher Syrek was Lisa Wilson Foley's campaign manager in 2012, and Lauren Casper was Lisa Wilson Foley's finance director in 2012. Casper has signed on with Tom Foley's campaign as his finance director, and Syrek, we believe, is the deputy treasurer for Tom Foley. And if you look at the indictment, the 21-page indictment of John Roland, it mentions unnamed campaign worker one and campaign worker two for Lisa Wilson Foley as having knowledge of this sham consulting arrangement, and talks about how that they are not co-conspirators or criminally charged with anything, but that they were witness to this. And so if you go and you look and see, start looking and see commonalities and names that work in the campaigns, start put two and two together, and basically Tom Foley's campaign volunteered that they were interviewed by the government as part of its investigation into Roland.
Well, I'm wondering, Neil, because you're finding this out at the same time that the Democratic State Party has been asking questions of Tom Foley, because he's worked in the past with John Roland. And I guess I'm wondering if there's any other ties that we see here about whether or not Tom Foley might in some ways be drawn more into a conversation about John Roland's past.
Well, Tom Foley has vehemently denied that there was any financial relationship with John Roland. What we do know is that Foley told the Hartford Current back in 2010 that Governor Rowland was helping him in Waterbury to kind of build his support there. And, of course, it naturally leads to the question, you know, did Governor Rowland get something in return for that? Given his track record, he, you know, does seem to command some kind of premium for doing things for people. So it's certainly a legitimate question. And, you know, Mr. Foley, you know, again, categorically denies that there's any relationship with Rowland. It has the potential to become this distraction for Foley over the summer months and kind of become a sideshow if two of his campaign aides are drawn into testifying in New Haven while he's trying to run a campaign.
And certainly before a campaign even really gets underway. If you want to read more, I'm reading this at StanfordAdvocate.com. He writes for the Hearst newspapers. Neil Vigdor joined us again. Neil, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, John. Have a great day.
And, Bill, we just have 15 seconds. Quick thought?
Just that there's a cluelessness about ethics issues, which are huge, not just in Connecticut but across the country. Tom Foley is the same guy who said that it had never been proven that Rowland did anything wrong. Now he hires these people. There's a tin ear to what would be, for a successful Republican candidate, one of the most important issues of a campaign.
Our political analyst, Bill Curry. When we come back, more with Alan Greenblatt from NPR.org and R.L. Levin Becker from the Connecticut Mirror. We'll talk basketball, burritos. We'll talk about the DSS. We'll take your phone calls, too, at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. And this is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. The cameras of CTN are here. They're taping our conversation for a future broadcast. And Bill Curry joins us. He's our political analyst, sitting in the seat of Colin McEnroe, who's taking a little bit of time away. Ariel Levin Becker is here from the Connecticut Mirror. We also have on the phone with us from NPR.org, Alan Greenblatt, who covers politics. We're taking some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Let's quickly go to Hashim, who's calling from Hampton. Good to hear from you, Hashim. What's on your mind?
I'm calling, Colin, again. I mean, John, thanks for you guys' wonderful show. I'm calling to ask a question, and I don't mean to be offensive to any Connecticut resident, but I'm wondering if the people of Connecticut actually think when it comes to politics, if they apply any intellect, or do they just pretty much go with the PR thing? Because if you look way back to even Lowell Weicker, Connecticut hasn't been too, outside of L.O.T. Grasso, hasn't had a good go with governors in this state.
Well, so Hashim asked the big question. Bill, you ran for this job a couple times. He says, haven't been a whole lot of great Connecticut governors. Maybe that's Hashim's opinion. What do you say?
I think that there's the Connecticut has to some degree been a backwater. We were one of the last states to modernize our legislature. We've put up with a kind of cozy politics, reminiscent of machine politics, for a long, long time. And so I don't think we've been the luckiest. On the other hand, you know, if you didn't admire Lowell Weicker's willingness to stand up for what he believed in and try to put, you know, forward an agenda, regardless of your opinion of the income tax and so forth, if you didn't admire the clarity of vision and the courage of it, then you weren't paying attention. Rowland was such an unmitigated disaster, both on a policy level as well as in terms of the corruption, that I just think it's left a lot of people feeling the same way as the caller and generalizing it to politics. And the danger here is that we become so frustrated and so cynical that we give up on our own ability to change things. You know, as same before, you know, Shabazz Napier showed what a single citizen can do with even an institution as autocratic as the NCAA. You can make changes here, and if anything, the pace of progress in Connecticut since Rowland, I would say, has picked up. There's reason to be hopeful here.
We'll come back to Shabazz Napier in just a moment. I just want to ask Alan Greenblatt about that. It's something we hear an awful lot from people that, you know, we don't like the people we send to Congress. We don't like the people that we've elected to governor. As you look around the United States and you look at political races all around, do you hear voices like Hashim's that we just heard saying, you know, in Indiana, in Florida, in Texas and Wyoming, we don't have the leaders that we really should have in our states?
Well, what's really interesting about this moment is people are always mad at politicians. They always think they're corrupt. They're always given reason to think that politicians are incompetent. But right now we're running this great experiment as a nation where we really do have red states and blue states. And so your state has passed all these bills we're talking about earlier, the minimum wage increase, a gun control measure, a big tax increase early in the governor's term. None of these things would fly in Tennessee or Texas. And in those places, you know, they're putting in new abortion restrictions. They're loosening gun laws. I mean, you know, we have a very stark divide on states that allow same-sex marriage and those that don't. And so the question is, you know, people have a real choice right now. Nothing is happening in Congress. You know, I've heard arguments that more people are happier this way, that more people in Texas and Arizona like those conservative policies. More people in Connecticut and Massachusetts like the liberal policies. And if there were a mushy compromise in Congress, more people would be dissatisfied. I don't know that I buy that, but it's an interesting thought. But, you know, things are happening at the state level that are not happening in Washington. So you have your choice. You can be mad at Washington for being dysfunctional and not getting anything done. You can be mad at your state government for getting a lot done that you don't like.
Of course, one of the things that – quickly, Bill, yeah.
Yeah, just – I just want to point out what the caller specifically pointed to was the mere marketing that we get, that the absolute lack of substance. And I think that people are depressed about the cynicism and the corruption of politics, but most of all, they're alienated by its emptiness. And the way politicians talk to people shows that the opinion of the candidates for the electorate has dropped at least as fast and far as the opinion of the electorate regarding the candidates and office holders. They're not respecting the public. We don't respect our own democracy, our own public, with the kind of debate we run.
Well, one of the things I wanted to get to, though, is the functions of government at the state level go far beyond politics. Of course, we look for politicians to run for office once again, and that consumes a lot of our time and our thought. But, Ariel, you cover the way government works in social services, for instance. You've been writing quite a bit, and we've talked to you about something, I won't say simple, but something that is key to governmental function. We have a Department of Social Services that is supposed to take care of the needs of many in our state. They've been undergoing a quote-unquote modernization effort, trying to serve the public better, and we've been hearing about it for a long time. How are they doing? You just did a checkup.
That's right. The Department of Social Services serves about 750,000 state residents, so it's quite a lot of people. And one of the things they changed last summer was to create a system of call centers. There are three call centers. So if you need to reach DSS to speak to a worker, you call one number, and in theory, you'll reach a worker there. In the past, you would have had to call your specific caseworker, and it was very hit or miss whether you would have reached that person. Often people would get voicemails, mailboxes that were full because workers were very overworked. And so the suggestion was that this would be much better. People would have a single place to call. And initially, the wait times at the call centers were extremely high. People were very frustrated. They were saying it could take over an hour, sometimes 2 hours of being on hold to speak to a worker. DSS officials said, you know, it's going to stabilize. You're going to have some lower call times. But critics of the system said, no, you need more workers staffing the phones.
Including lawsuits to try to get more workers to actually man the phones.
Correct. Or the lawsuit was to get more workers to process applications. But that's related. So last week, DSS sort of presented their first of what they call the dashboard of how they're doing. And it had some data. And so they said in the month of March, the average wait time to speak to a DSS worker on their phone line was, I believe it was 39 minutes and 29 seconds, which is down from an hour and 13 minutes in February. It was a little bit higher than that in January. So you know, to them, they said, you know, look, we have more work to do, but we're making a lot of progress. One of the other numbers that they didn't present, but I was able to get from the department was the total number of calls and the number of calls that actually went through. And what that showed is that 2/3 of the people who actually call end up hanging up before they speak to somebody. And so for clients and for client advocates, that's a real problem. And people will say, you know, that really calls into question that 39-minute figure, because if you have people who are waiting an average of 15 minutes before hanging up, that sort of artificially lowers your average call time. And so how long are people actually waiting before they reach someone?
It's like, how real are the unemployment numbers if people are dropping out of the workforce, for instance? Yeah.
Right. And I think it's a particular concern for people who are low income, many of whom who have cell phones with limited minutes. So it means that, you know, if you're using up your minutes to try to reach someone because your Medicaid benefits got cut off inaccurately, or you didn't get your food stamps this month, even though you still qualify, that can be a real burden for people.
And Bill, this is an important issue, down to 39 minutes. But yes, if you're looking for work and you've got 200 minutes on your cell phone plan, waiting online for 40 minutes isn't
right.
a good deal.
You're poor, so you can just sit there is really the message that I would take from it. And, you know, I've said on this show before, if, you know, the person who really, really fixes the Department of Motor Vehicles will be a folk hero in this state. You know, people will sing songs about them for generations. And the thing about it's not that hard. One of the myths we have about the responsiveness of state and federal government is that state government is generally more responsive, and it generally isn't. There was a study done by one of the national business groups of consumer satisfaction. They did both private and public agencies, and they found that the Social Security Agency had the highest level of consumer satisfaction, just beating out Disneyland. And when you look at what Ariel's fine work on this or at any one of these agencies, it isn't that hard. It can be done. The amount of money we're talking about staffing is not that great. Fixing the systems, giving it not just money but the quality of administrative attention that it requires can really happen. And the second thing about her work, she did a great job getting extra figures. Politicians in office treat information that ought to be public as if it were proprietary. We're all guessing whether the 7.5 million people are 1/3 previously insured or not. We guess at what these figures mean. There's a movement across this country to establish the principle that all information that government holds is the property of the democracy, not the government, and certainly not of the politicians who run it. It would be so much easier to solve this with an open infrastructure in which the democracy got to participate.
Just wanted to add, there are also laws that say that's the case.
Yes, and it's the law, a minor point that Ariel brings up, but nonetheless worthwhile.
aside from that, we want to move on to our last topic of the day, and it has to do with how the NCAA has responded to some comments from UConn's own Shabazz Napier about going hungry at times, about UConn athletes and athletes all around the country not having food money. As always, The Daily Show's John Stewart had a take.
Maybe if these athletes, who have just directly poured millions into the coffers of the University of Connecticut, are hungry, they could take advantage of the local businesses who are giving away everything from drinks to froyo to the craziest of breads to reward UConn's national championships. If, of course, that was in any way legal under NCAA rules governing the acceptance by athletes of anything of monetary or caloric value.
So as suggested earlier in the program, now under a plan proposed just Tuesday by the NCAA Legislative Council, Division I student athletes could now receive unlimited meals and snacks. It seems to be in direct response to the comments by Shabazz Napier after his win. I know Miles is on the line. He's calling in from UConn. Miles, what do you think of this?
I just think it's a great idea.
So you think it's a great idea? Do you think Shabazz had anything to do with this?
I wouldn't be surprised. You know, they just won the national championship. So, you know, he played a huge role in that. And now that they've done this, you know, just, I guess, like a week after they won, you know, it definitely says something about his comments about the team.
I wonder, Bill Curry, what do you think this really means? I mean, the NCAA has been talking about change for some time, and there's been almost no change happening. And then within just the last several months, we see this lawsuit, and we see the possibility of unionization of Northwestern football players. We see more conversations about whether or not student-athletes should be paid or whether or not they should be able to get endorsement deals. Do you think that there's change afoot here?
Yeah, I do. And it's emblematic of what's happening throughout the society. You know, we are, if we're lucky, we are in the last stages of the corporatization and monetization of all of life and the concentration of power that's gone with it, both political and economic. And there are so many ways in which people are trying to are struggling now to put a check on that power, as we have during our great reform times. And the students are just one example. I mean, the amount of money pouring into the NCAA from these television contracts is overwhelming. It drives these conferences. You know, we used to be the Yankee Conference with playing schools we knew that you could take a bus. All the students got tickets. The place went nuts. In every sense, whether it's the corporate ticket holders or the corporate names of the stadiums that are far or playing in Houston rather than Providence, everything's being driven by money. And as elsewhere in the economy, the actual producers of the bounty are not being taken care of. And so Shabazz Napier, I just thought it was – he's such an interesting guy, and it was such a wonderful moment when he stood up and did that, and a really telling moment when the NCAA, feeling the pressure you talked about, turned around and said, sure.
Well, so this is a little tiny salvo and something that may be a big change. Alan Greenblatt, you've written about this a bit for NPR.org. I mean, do you see a change coming in the people that you're talking to, that perhaps student-athletes getting paid actual salaries or larger stipends is something that is going to happen anytime soon?
I don't know how soon it'll happen. To me, it does seem a little inevitable. I mean, you have this corporatization that Bill is talking about. It has already happened. There are endorsement deals. I mean, if you're a reporter and you're sitting courtside, you cannot have a beverage with a different brand than the one sponsoring the tournament. So
unbelievable.
Everyone is benefiting except the students. And so the students are going to come up with more and more examples of what they see as unfair treatment. I mean, aren't you shocked that the athletes are not fed as much as they want? Don't you have visions of these heaping training tables? I mean, of all the things that athletes should be given, you'd think nourishment and calories would be a pretty big no-brainer. Anyway, they'll keep coming up with examples where they're able to convince people it's unfair that they're not getting, given what they're contributing to this whole system.
Well, Alan Greenblatt writes for NPR.org. Thank you so much for your time, Alan. I also want to thank Bill Curry, our political analyst. Thank you, Bill. Good to see you.
Great to be here.
And also thanks to Ariel Levenbecker from the Connecticut Mirror. Good to see you, Ariel.
Thanks, John.
We didn't even get a chance to talk about the fact that Moe's Burritos put out $500,000 on a bet that UConn wouldn't win both national titles. I know a lot of people went out and got some cheap burritos. It was certainly a good deal for UConn Huskies fans, not such a great deal for Moe's. Coming up next, we're going to hear from some of my colleagues who are going to tell you what a great deal public radio is. Hope you can stay tuned. This is Where We Live.